I got a letter last December, and I get a fair amount of email from people I've known or church members or others that somehow come onto the archives or such. So I get a fair amount of email that comes through and correspondence, but I don't get a lot of letters. Letters are, what can I say? That's the way we used to do business. Letters, though, take time. It takes more energy to stop and actually write it out and post it and postage it and respond. And the letter I got actually was requesting a particular response. So I took the letter and I put it on my to-do pile on my desk. It's right there to my left of my main part of the desk. I got this large desk that operates also as a storage area. Anyway, I put it on my to-do pile and I left for a Challenger 2 program in Tucson. Now, the problem with that is the to-do pile never quite gets cleared up, and whenever I go on a trip and I come back, there's a new pile that has to be set somewhere on the desk, and so we have journals and ledgers and correspondence, and Michelle pays the bills that are due when I'm gone, the ones leaves the notes, the ones that are still out their way, she leaves for me, and I handle those when I get back. And so there's a pile of things that land back on my desk again, and the fact is that letter never really saw the light of day, to speak politely. More trips followed. There were trips into the summer. And so about right before the feast, I had decided that I would make a superhuman effort, possibly, hopefully, and clear my desk to the point where I could actually see the wood on my desk, because I needed to know what was down in those stacks, and I wanted to care for it and not be as negligent maybe as at least I had been. And I got down to the letter. And so I responded to the letter saying, why don't you send me an email? So I put it off at least that far. And the email came through when I was at the feast, and so I wanted to try in that sense to respond. But I want to read you just a couple of notes from this letter I got. It says, just heard one of your older sermons about the Spirit, where you share how you were inspired to write your first sermon. And that goes back, I'd have to go look at that, but somewhere back in the archives, there's a sermon that I made reference to the fact that the very first sermon I ever wrote was before I was even on the sermon roster. I was in Boise. I was in training, wasn't ordained yet. The ministry there was using me for various sundry grunt-type duties, and to make sure that my attitude and preparation for the ministry was in place. And so I was serving and working and helping and giving sermonettes and such, leading songs. And anyway, I had never had an occasion yet where I needed to give a sermon, so I hadn't actually written any. But I'm driving along in the car, and I'm heading from Boise out to the farmlands of eastern Oregon. It was a long ride that day where I was headed, 4 hours out, maybe a little more. Took time, and as I was driving along, a sermon came to mind. It just like popped into my mind, and I began to think and reason. And so I had a yellow pad. I laid it next to me on the seat, and I'm driving on. I'm just scribbling on the pad and flipping it over. And I walked through the sermon in my mind and scribbled an outline on paper, literally from title to introduction to SPS. Back then I used an SPS. These days I don't. On to the body and the points and the conclusion to the finish. And it was all laid out in order. And I said, well, that's amazing. And I thought, I don't even need that. But it's there. Someday, you know, I'll need that. Well, got back home after that trip, back to Boise. And within a short week or so, there was a request from Randy Scriber, who's the pastor of the next circuit, saying, look, I'm going to have to leave. I've got to be out of my area. Would you send Mark over to cover my circuit for me? And I thought, well, that's remarkable. You know, God made provision in that way. Well, again, the lady here that wrote me the letter says, may I ask what that first sermon was and if I can have a copy of it? I'm rather certain that you must have treasured it as I did my first inspired writing and have it saved. And so she had reflected earlier that she liked to write and music, at least in part, and that I must have treasured this first sermon and kept it in a very special place. I kept that in a very special place. I'm not sure where it is anymore, that special place. I used to carry that sermon in the back of, well, not in my Bible, but in my Bible case. And the reason I did is because I went ahead and gave that sermon in Idaho at that time. And then later we were transferred to Nebraska. And as I remember, I gave the sermon and reworked a bit and used the material, the research, in Nebraska. And then we were transferred to Texas after that. Well, at some point, I took and I decided I would save that because it was fairly generic. It was on overcoming. And I figured I would use that as my spare. Because one day somebody doesn't bring the tape or the preparation, or somebody doesn't show up that's supposed to speak because they're in an accident, or something happens, or you go someplace at the feast and somebody asks you to assist at a small site. And there would be something. And so I kept that sermon aside without using it further, and the notes were actually in my Bible case. I really wonder where that case went. Because the notes are gone as well. And I wouldn't have never checked. But when this lady asked, I said, well, I know the title. The title was Stumbling Blocks to Overcoming Your Problems. And then I remember the second title because I said, well, that might sound negative. So the next time I use that material, I put, you know, Stepping Stones to Overcoming Your Problems. That's more positive. It's the same material, but from a different perspective. And I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it on my computer, and I couldn't find it in my files. I could find it on my sermon log. Michelle, when she files my sermons, types it all up, and there is this name way back there. It's possible I've got some old floppy disks in the closet that my computer won't even read anymore. And those were my old backup files from who knows what program that I was using to back up way back then. So I'm sure they're accessible maybe by the CIA, but I don't know if they're accessible by, they're not accessible by me for certain. But anyway, I didn't have time last night to do that, and so I just thought, I'll tell you what, I'll just write it again. Maybe God will inspire me to address some of the same material. And so I took the title of the first one and the title of the second one, and I crunched it down, and when Alan called me last night, I just said, look, the title is Stumble or Step. And it means, effectively, is there something that's going to cause us to fall or stumble, an obstacle in front of us? Or is it not the same thing in some way, if we use it well, that we can use it to step up and to go on and to finish? So I thought I would at least address in a framework. Mike giving a split sermon made it a little easier than that, because, amazingly, the sermon that I first wrote had 7 points. Can you imagine in the decades of the church that we would have sermons with 7 points? I remember sermons with 12 points, you know, complete. Can you imagine having 144 points? I mean, that would be the maximum. But anyway, since these are more current times and I'm on a shorter time frame, I only made 3 points. I'm also getting older, and so I thought I would only speak a little bit if I needed to in this case. I wanted to go back, pull some of the things that I could out of that long-lost sermon, wherever it is stored these days, and I want to address what are some of the things specifically that, on the one hand, if they are small in our perspective, they can cause us to stumble. We're talking now strengths, character strengths. Or if they are large in our perspective, they will give us a step ahead, a chance to go forward in that way. Mark chapter 9. In verse number 14, gives reference here. Again, where I could, I tried to pull in some of the specific points that I had addressed, even though some of that now is lost to my memory. Mark 9 and verse number 14. So when he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them, scribes disputing with them, Jesus Christ here. Immediately when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed, and running to him, they greeted him. And he asked the scribes, what are you discussing with them? One said to the multitude and answered, Teacher, I brought you my son, who has a mute spirit. Whoever seizes him, he throws him down, foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I spoke to your disciples that they should cast him out, and they could not. And he answered and said, O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me. The issue here is faith. If your faith is small, it can cause you to stumble, to come up short. If your faith is strong, then indeed it becomes a step and a strength and a continuance in a spiritual way. So they brought him to him, and he saw him, and immediately the spirit convulsed him. He fell to the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth, and he asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? He said, well, from childhood. How many of our obstacles in our lives, our problems, how many of our emotional, mental struggles in our lives, the things that we face, have been happening to us for years and years and years? How many times do we fight the same battles? Often he's been throwing him both into the fire, into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. If you have enough faith, indeed, it will be responded to you accordingly. Notice the response. The father said, immediately cried out with tears, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. You see, the Lord, I believe, is the stumbling block. That is the part to where he has some, but not what he really needs. And Christ said, well, if you really believe, and he said, give me the rest. Help me. When we have a struggle or an obstacle or a trouble or a trial, and we're trying to walk through it and past it and to go on, it becomes a step up. When it becomes an obstacle that causes us to draw back or pull back or turn aside, it becomes an obstacle. And the difference might indeed be as simple as our degree of faith. It says, verse 25, when Jesus saw the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, said, you deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more. The spirit cried out, convulsed him greatly, came out of him, and he became as one dead, so that many thought indeed that he was dead. Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up, and he arose. When he had gone into the house, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast him out? And he said to them, this kind cannot come out by nothing but prayer and fasting. And again, as I've addressed that part in the past, in advance. There was no time to stop and build your faith. There was no way to stop long enough to strengthen in order to fulfill God's will. To stop and build your faith would have required the process to be incomplete. Dari and I had to address an issue this year at the feast of a demon again, as we have had to on some occasions in the past. And again, in this case, I expected instantaneous response, that it would be done, that we would address it, and the situation would be over, and this time, there was not. This time, it didn't end the minute it was addressed. And I sat there, and I'm thinking, this is not right. This cannot be. This will not happen this way. It is not what God's will would have it. We have addressed it. It must be finished. And there was actually a process of time there where this issue did not resolve itself. And then finally, indeed it did. But I looked back and I just thought, you know, I can't go back to my room and pray about this. I don't have the option to go and fast and try to strengthen my focus, but Christ said that there are some times that it takes more faith. Brethren, that faith needs to be put in place. I suggest as we enter the times that we're entering into, which I believe is walking into the finish of this age, I suggest that we concentrate on building our faith. I think God is helping us to build it by allowing the church members to walk through trials and tests in various ways, in many, many places, to build our faith, so that when the big trouble and trial comes, it will be in place. Ephesians chapter 2 at verse number 8. Feast this year, the announcement had been made that Michelle had collapsed and been at the feast and gone to the hospital, and the announcement was made in Nigeria at the feast, and the brethren there were very, very concerned. And they would come up to me every day. I mean, literally, people would be waiting at the door as I came in to know if I had been in contact with her, if there was any information, any update. And a number of the ladies there would say to me, by the time you get home, she will be well. I said, on more than one occasion, I said, did God tell you that? You see, the problem there is simply a difference in culture. Because what all they were really saying was, look, God will be with you. You will see. But because of the way they process it and the way it was expressed, it came across to me as, I'm letting you know this will certainly happen and be so. Well, when I came home, indeed, she was not well yet. God is in charge, and He's building our faith through the circumstances that we walk through today. It's an important process. We will be well, but we will be well according to God's will and in His time. Ephesians 2, verse number 8, says, by grace you have been saved through faith, that not of yourselves. Faith is not something you work up. It is not in and of itself an emotion. I remember a time when an employee of the campus in Pasadena, California, was hit by a car, and I remember sitting in the hospital in emergency while his life hung in the balance, and I absolutely believed that he would be healed. I believed it. I was convinced that it would be so, and he died. And I had to address that in my mind afterwards. That was my human emotion. That was not faith that is a gift of God, where God put in my mind what His will would be. Not that His will overall, but His will in a specific way. That was my human emotion. That God would do it in that way at that time, because it did not happen. So let me say that our faith is not something that we work up. The man said, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. He says, I have put into it what I have, you put into it what I have not. You give me that which I have. But he had to reach for it. He wasn't sitting in his chair with a remote in his hand asking God to simply input what he needed to while he was finishing his current series of programming. He was reaching for it, and God turned and granted him according to his desire. It says, by grace you have been saved through faith, that is not of yourselves. It is the gift of God. Do we lack faith? God says it is His gift. But we reach for it. We have to yearn for it. We have to apply that which we already have and ask for more. Not of works, lest anyone should boast, for we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works. What Mike was addressing in his sermon today, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Now, I think faith is probably critical and fundamental, and I think it becomes the difference sometimes between whether we stop or stumble or draw back, or whether we step up and reach up and go on. I think there's something else that falls in that category, and that would be our zeal. A small amount of zeal. Well, I guess zeal by definition includes something that would be more than small, but if we have little desire, then that becomes a stumbling block that stands in our way. But if we have great desire, if we have much zeal, then again, that becomes a stepping stone, a chance, an opportunity to lift up and to go on. 2 Kings chapter 13. I remember this particular passage coming to mind way, way back then. And it's always stuck in my mind as something rather unique, and I've tried to think about it from time to time in terms of my own personal focus. But 2 Kings 13 and verse number 14 says the death of Elisha, at least as the heading. Elisha had become sick with the illness of which he would die. And Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over his face and said, oh, my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen. And Elisha said to him, take a bow and some arrows. He took himself a bow and some arrows. He said to the king of Israel, put your hand on the bow. And he put his hand on it, and Elisha put his hands on the king's hands. He said, open the east window. And he opened it, and Elisha said, shoot. And he shot. He said, the arrow of the Lord's deliverance and the arrow of deliverance from Syria. He said, that's what that arrow symbolizes, your deliverance from your enemy. He said, you must strike the Assyrians at Aphek until you have destroyed them. That's the meaning of the arrow. He said, take the arrow now. He took them. And he said to the king, strike the ground. He struck the ground 3 times, and he stopped. And the man of God was angry with him. He said, you should have struck 5 or 6 times, and you would have struck Syria until you had destroyed it. But now you will strike Syria only 3 times, and you will not succeed. Elisha died. They buried him. The raiding bands from Moab invaded the land in the spring of the year, which obviously followed by oppression from Syria that later came as well. But it goes back and shows that what Elijah said was true. And he gave the king the key to solve the problem. But the king simply never used it and took it in the way that it was meant. They were burying a man. Suddenly they spied a band of raiders. They put the man in the tomb of Elisha. When the man was let down and touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood on his feet. Again, God just saying, that was my servant. In the context of this passage, that was my counsel, and you could have overcome. How many times have you had to face the same battle, walk through the same steps, respawn, return, get back up, and go in the same way again? 3 times. 6. 70 times 7. Over the decades of your life and your calling and your service to God, it does not matter. What matters is that you continue, that we all continue, that we don't just stop and pull up short, but that we always go on. Where does zeal come from? Well, where did faith come from? Well, zeal comes from God. But we reach for it in the same way that that man did with his child who needed God's intervention. Zeal comes out of our focus. What's the problem with our focus? The problem with our focus is we live in a society that wants to give us everything we desire, to lay it at our feet, to use up our time, to fill our time, to consume our energy. And yet zeal means that we have kept our focus in a very specific way. It's kind of fascinating to me as I travel and I watch it, and when I leave Nigeria, it's all day up before the airport. The flight goes out at like 10:30 at night. You fly all night from Nigeria to Amsterdam, and I don't rest very well on a plane, so I busy myself or just lay my head back, turn off the video, close the eye, you know, at least. It serves some energy. Number of hours there in Amsterdam, and then 9 hours back over to Portland or Seattle. There have been more than one trip where I was so fired up about a particular project, you can just wonder what maybe that would be, working on that index. As I mentioned once before, we landed in Seattle one time, and I said, well, that was a little too short. And the waitress stewardess just looked at me like, that's a very strange man sitting there. But again, it was the matter of the driving will and focus. Now, there's all kinds of time in my life when I can't just wait for... At 6 o'clock at night, I can't wait to go to bed. I just want to quit. I'm tired. I'm done. I don't want any more. I just want it to be over for the day so I can rest and maybe start anew. So we live on both sides of that equation. But I know what the difference is basically for me. It's focus. When I narrow my focus to something that is important in my mind, then I want to do it. And I can overcome the frustration, I can overcome the sleepy time, I can overcome the interruptions. You know, we always come down together now with someone's sermonette, and sometimes there's family in the car, and sometimes the children want to be active in some way. And the fact is, when I'm stopped and working on my sermon in the car as I'm coming down trying to wrap it up or make the transitions more smooth, it really doesn't matter what's going on around me anymore, because I'm down to the last requirement that I have, and all those other things fade away. I think that applies to us in many, many respects. Our zeal largely depends on our focus. What is it that's rising to the top of our to-do list? What is it that's on the surface that is the next thing we want to do? Timothy was given instruction by Paul that he had the ability to increase his focus and to increase his service to God in that way. 2 Timothy 1 and verse number 3. In reference to the use of the Holy Spirit. Paul says, I thank God, whom I serve with a pure conscience, as my forefathers did, as without ceasing I remember you in my prayers night and day, greatly desiring to see you, being mindful of your tears, that I may be filled with joy. When I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois, your mother Eunice, I am persuaded is in you also. Is it enough to have the Holy Spirit? It is not. You have to be fruitful. I have to be fruitful. We have to be led by the Spirit. You can have the Holy Spirit and it can be, to some stage, even acting as being dormant. It can be quenched. It can be reduced. So he says, therefore, I remind you, stir up the gift of God that is in you through the laying on of my hands. Fire it up. Get it going. Get it moving again. God has not given us a spirit of fear. Fear means to pull back or turn away or draw back, but of power, of love, and of a sound mind. I thought that was just interesting that Paul said, you know, Timothy could then say, well, I have indeed some zeal. Give me more zeal. I am serving you, but I want to serve you better. And so we have to have that core, but God's gift that we reach out to Him for, He gives to us so that we can stir it up and engage in a much further way. We have to have our faith, and our faith must be strong. God gives that to us if we reach out to Him. We have to be zealous and desirous and fruitful, and that must be strong. And God gives that to us again. If we reach out to Him. What is it we must do, though, even with faith and with zeal? We must continue. We must absolutely continue, no matter what. In the book of Genesis, chapter 32, and verse 22, is the account of Jacob here. Jacob wrestling with God. I think it's fascinating. Anybody here actually been in wrestling? I was in wrestling in junior high. I didn't like it very much. It was one of the toughest things I thought I had ever done. One of the most intense and strenuous things that I had ever done. You know, you ride your bicycle and you sprint up a hill, you get the coast down the other side. In wrestling, there was never a coast until it was over. You either won or you lost, and then it was over. It says, he arose that night, took his two wives, two maidservants, his 11 sons, crossed over the ford of Jabbok. He's going out here effectively to meet Esau, and this is the middle of the story. It says, he took them and sent them over the brook and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man, Jesus Christ, who reduced himself into the flesh to wrestle with Jacob, wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. Now, I don't even know how to describe that. Because we're talking matches that go for minutes that would be described here as some process that took place over an entire evening. And we saw that he did not prevail against him because Jacob simply would not give up. He touched the socket of his hip. The socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. Jacob continued on wrestling, now wrestling injured. He said, let me go. The day breaks. He said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. There was a specific intent in Jacob's mind. He said, what is your name? He said, Jacob. He said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. How many times do we have to continue to fire up our spirit, to continue to reach for our faith and continue? Till it's over. Till it's done. And we're not done. We're still here, are we not? And Jacob asked him, saying, tell me your name, I pray. And he said, what is it that you ask about my name? And why is it that you ask about my name? And he blessed him there. Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God's face to face, seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Just as he crossed over Peniel, the sun rose, and notice he says, he limped on his hip. He was injured as he walked away. Now, I don't know the whole means of that story, and I don't know exactly what Jacob knew in asking for that blessing, but he obviously knew enough to ask, and he knew who it was that he wrestled with. He knew that he could not win, but he knew that he could prevail, if I can make a distinction. He didn't win by overcoming that man as such that he wrestled with as it was portrayed. He won because he never quit. That's how he prevailed. He continued in there as long as it took to receive his blessing. Anybody here tired? Anybody here been in the church for decades and used up the youthfulness of your early years of the church and your calling? Anybody here think we're not actually running down the home stretch? Can you imagine you run a race? I was in track too. And you come around that last turn. And here's the stretch, the home stretch, and it's straight. And anybody that's got any juice left in them kicks it, and they begin to try to pull away in that last part. And you're trying to stay in there and hold on. I wasn't a great runner. I was a sprint. I ran sprints. I ran hurdles. I did some high jump. I stayed away from the distance running because, frankly, it was just too painful. It was just too painful. And if I could have gone out there and jogged around the track, I don't care. I jog now. I can run for miles. But that's not the same. It's at my leisure. These were people that were actually trying to win. One time, during the track season, the coach, knowing that I had so many points, and it took a few more points to get your letter, you had to get like 5 points for the letter, and you get points for finishing in certain places, he put me in the mile run, and I thought he was kind of crazy that he would put me in a mile run. That wasn't my sport. I hadn't even trained for it. But he stuck me in the mile run. He said, you know, you're in. So I lined up and we started around the track, and there's four times around this track here. I remember going around each time and watching these people that are professional, I thought, by my comparison to me, leave me. You know, one guy finally passed me. You know, he laps me and he's tearing off now. I'm going down on this last lap, and I'm down the straightaway on the opposite side, and the crowd's all kind of yelling and stuff for the people on the winning side on the other end, and I'm embarrassed that, you know, they're crossing the line and I'm clear over on the other side of the track. And finally I was slowing down. Of course, I'm hurting, and I'm telling myself I'm hurting and this is painful and I shouldn't have been in this race anyway. And I slowed down and slowed down. Finally, I just stopped, stepped off into the crowd. I'm looking over at the finish line on the other side. I'm now a spectator, and the coach is over there, and he's counting the runners, and I just never came in. I never crossed the line. And afterwards, you know, he was less than pleased with me, but he never chewed me out or anything. He just said, well, you know what? All you had to do in that race was finish to get your points. We didn't have enough runners to fill all the places. I could have walked across the line. And I could have got my points. And I could have got my letter. And I could have stuck it on a sweater or something and walked around like it was for real. And I just, frankly, kind of burned out in my own mind, and I quit. That was a pretty sad day. All I had to do was simply keep running. I didn't even have to win. I didn't have to come in first. We've run the gun lap, if you've been here for decades, how many times? How many gun laps? I mean, Mr. Armstrong used to call the gun lap. Time and time again, we run, and then the race wasn't over. Some people quit. In fact, most people quit. Seems to. We haven't. I got my Outside magazine, came in this month, and it had a picture on the front of Michael Phelps, who won the 8 gold medals, along with the assistance of some of his teammates at the Olympics. And it lays it out in terms of the 8 days here where the races were run, and it makes comments on the races. And I want to show you just a little bit. I mean, I can't tell you about his training. I don't know about his training. And frankly, during the Olympics, I was at the feast in Nigeria, and I didn't get to see it anyway. As I remember, it was I was somewhere. I was on some trip somewhere whenever this happened. But it goes through, let me read it to you. The first race, August 10th, okay, that goes back to camp. That's obviously not the feast, that's the youth camp. The 400 individual medley, the threat. At the 200 meter mark, all three top swimmers were neck and neck. So he comes into halfway through the race, and the three top swimmers are all tied as they turn the stretch. It says, Phelps surged ahead in the freestyle leg, and he won handily. So that wasn't as big of a crisis as maybe it could have been, but he pulled it out. That was number one. Number two, and to remind us, no one has ever won 8 gold medals in the Olympics ever in the history. Unprecedented. The front of the page says, the world's greatest athlete. Now, that's a matter of opinion, but the fact is, that's how they've listed it in this case. August the 11th, the 4x100 freestyle relay. The threat, the French talk trash, and nearly backed it up. A quarter of the way through the last leg, Phelps teammate Jason Lezak, the U.S.'s anchor leg swimmer, found himself nearly an entire body length behind French swimmer Alain Bernard. The last length, he's a body length behind. These are professional Olympic athletes, and I guess professional is an oxymoron with the word Olympic, but I'm talking about in terms of their training. In the last 25 meters, Lezak drafted off of Bernard, who was swimming in an adjacent lane, and pulled out one of the greatest comebacks in the history of sport swimming, beating Bernard by 0.08 of a second. He was a body length behind. He absolutely refused to sign it off or toss it in. He drafted next to the lane to get a little bit of a break and pushed, and in 0.08 of a second came in and took the gold for his team. Number three, August 12th, 200 freestyle, the threat, none. Phelps beat second place by nearly 2 seconds. Okay, so that medal came in an easier fashion. August 13th, the 200 butterfly, the threat. Phelps' goggles began to pool up immediately on entering the water. His goggles were leaking. With 75 meters to go, he couldn't make out the wall for the turn or the finish line. He couldn't see. His goggles had filled with water. Phelps remained calm, counted his strokes, and captured another gold. He counted his strokes and turned based on when he knew the wall would be there, and he finished and won the gold. Goggles full of water, couldn't see. Never quit. Never signed off. Never said, well, that's too much of an obstacle. I got a problem. I got something in my way. This isn't fair. No, he never backed off. August the 13th, 5x200 freestyle relay. The threat, zilch. Phelps and company became the first team to break the 7-minute barrier. August 15th, there's 1 day break. The 200 individual medley. The threat. Phelps had about 7 minutes between the 200 medal ceremony for the individual medley and the semifinals for the 100 butterfly, which left him no time to rest. The medal was still in his warm-up jacket as he qualified second in the 100 butterfly semifinal. So he had to go on straight from there into the race and run and didn't have time to even stop. He qualified enough to get in the race. August 16th, the 100 butterfly, the threat. Serbian swimmer Milorad Kavic told press that Phelps losing the event would be a good thing for swimming. Nearing the wall, Kavic extended his arms and glided toward the touch pad. Phelps, instead of gliding, decided to take a furious last-second half stroke. There wasn't time, place to even take a stroke. And he just took a short, quick half stroke, which, it turned out, was imperceptibly faster. He won the gold by 1/100 of a second with that effort, with that extra effort, with that little extra push. One more little push. The smallest margin of victory in swimming. Phelps tied Olympic legend Mark Spitz's record 7 gold medals, the most won in any Olympic Games at any time. August 17th, number 8, the record. 4x100 medley relay, the threat. After 2 legs, the backstroke and the breaststroke, Phelps found himself in third position as he started the 3rd leg. His strong butterfly leg put the team back in first place, setting the stage for their freestyle relay star, Lizak, who brought the team in first and with a world record. Phillips became the first athlete to win 8 gold medals in 1 Olympics. I just thought it was striking. It wasn't just years of training, years of dedication from the time that he was young. It was at the moment, no matter what, if you're third place, if you're a body length behind, if you're absolute neck and neck, that some, a little extra effort and to continue on and to fight that race to finish, and he got the golds and he got the medals and his teammates were there as well. What has God said? He who does the most eventually gets credit for it. He who has the largest, bright, and shining burst will always be remembered for that great service that he gave me. Well, yes and no. Matthew 10 and verse number 16. He who finishes, he who never, ever quits, goes on to the very last moment and never turns back or aside, always continues until the end. Matthew 10, verse number 16. It says, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be wise as serpents, harmless as doves. Beware of men, they will deliver you up to councils, scourge you in their synagogues." We haven't reached that point yet in our time. We will. "You'll be brought before governors and kings for my sake as testimony to them, to the Gentiles. And when they deliver you up, don't worry about what you'll speak. What will be given to you that hour, what you shall speak." Just like our faith is given to us when we reach for it. Our zeal is given to us when we strive for it. When we prepare ourselves, God will also give us that. "It is not you speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Brother will deliver up brother to death, and father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved." So, fine. We had some great years. We had some strong service. But we don't get to quit or turn aside. We have to finish the race. He who endures to the end will be saved. You know, as I said, I think my original sermon had 7 points. The sermon has only 3. There isn't as much that I really wanted to cover, and I wanted to focus on these things in maybe a stronger way. That doesn't mean that I've been able to cover exactly what it was that you have a personal need for in that way. The one issue that is your stumbling block or your stepping stone to overcoming in your personal life. Because you know what that is. God knows what that is. And God can lead me to assist in that way, but it's something you have to know for yourself. What is it in your own life that stands in your way? What is it that you walk up to and threatens you to turn back or aside? You've heard that comment that you can turn lemons into lemonade. You can turn, in that sense, a weakness into a strength. Look at the example of David. The thing about David is that he relied on God, but he also did his part. He prepared himself as well. 1 Samuel 16 is the account here where David is to be anointed king. But it goes down, and you go through the story of how David was picked, and Samuel goes to a sacrifice that he called Jesse to bring out his children, and he's there, and verse 5, he said, well, how do you come? He said, peaceably. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. He sanctified Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. And when it came, he looked to Eliab and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him, because one of the strong-looking young men, one of the tall men of the family was there, and certainly they would say, you must be looking to this man to select. And the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or the height of his stature. I have refused him. The Lord does not see as man sees. Man looks at the outward appearance, the Lord looks at the heart. David was the youngest of 8 children. He was the one that they left to tend the sheep. He didn't even get invited to be in appearance because he was the one that took care of the chores for the rest of the young men that were in his family in that way. Verse number 14. After the anointing, it goes on and talks about now Saul being troubled. It says, the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. And Saul's servant said to him, surely the distressing spirit from God is troubling you. Let our master command your servants who are before you and seek out a man, a skillful player in the harp. Took some time and focus. And it shall be that he will play it with his hand when the distressing spirit from God is upon you, and you shall be well. Saul said, well, provide me a man who can play well and bring him to me. One of his servant answers, says, look, I've seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a mighty man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, and handsome. Well, you can say, well, he stood head and shoulders above everybody else. He did not. We see that back on the anointing. And God told Samuel, don't look on his appearance. What did he do? He took what he had and he made it work. When David killed Goliath, he killed him with a stone to his forehead. You ever thrown a sling? You ever taken a rock and a sling and thrown and pitched it? How many times do you have to throw that stone before you can put it exactly in the place that you want it to be? So he's out there tending the sheep. And the other young men in his family are handling the affairs of the family or doing whatever their father pleased. And they're busy and maybe handling the finances and doing the more important chores. And David's out there tending the sheep. That is a weakness. That is a problem. He has been set aside. What did he do? Took out that sling and he would use that time and he would perfect his aim. And he got to where that he trusted on God. I don't care who you are. I think if you charge up against a lion or a bear, they'll probably just take you out. But if with courage and faith and zeal you charge up against a lion or a bear when it needs to be done, then I believe as a servant of God, God will help and protect and intervene on your behalf. So there was a spiritual component in all of that. David had that. When he went against Goliath, he says, let not man's heart fail because of him. There was conviction there, and there was courage. But God is the one who guided him in that specific way. 2 Corinthians 12 shows that Paul served God in weakness. 2 Corinthians 12 and verse number 7. A little slow on the pages today. He says, lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelation, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. It doesn't say he was anointed 3 times. It said he pleaded with God. He besought God. He cried out to God in a specific way 3 times. But God said, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Is your faith weak? Help my unbelief. Is your zeal weak? You know, reach out and cry out to God. Is your perseverance weak? God will see us through. But we have to be willing to strive. How many times have you taken out your sling and practiced hitting the rock onto a target where it needs to go? Not because you have time when Goliath is looking you in the eyes. These things only come out by prayer and fasting in advance. So we prepare in advance. And we don't know how God will use us. We study our Bible in advance. We memorize our scriptures in advance. We learn those lessons that we need to learn by the trials and the sacrifices and troubles that we walk through so that when the time comes and there is real trial and trouble before the kings and the governors of this earth, as the prophecy shows, then God will grant us what we also need in that day. He says, he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. So Paul said, then when I am weak, I am strong. The stumbling block becomes a stepping stone by the might and power of God, by Christ our Lord and Master as he works through us. Whether or not we turn back or turn aside, or whether or not we step up and go on, depends on us. God is there to give us. He gives us the help we need. We have to be willing to have faith and trust Him, to be fired up and zealous and strive to serve Him and to endure to the end.